Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Tricia Griffith, the very proud owner of WebSleuths.com, the best true crime discussion forum in the world, if I do say so myself, and host of the show Web Sleuths Radio. Now, why is it called Web Sleuths Radio and not Web Sleuths Podcast? Well, because I started it before I even knew the word podcast, and I'm that old. I'm kind of an old bat, so we're just keeping it with Web Sleuths Radio. And today, our guest is going to fascinate you. I don't think the hour that we have, or maybe two, if we can fit it in, I don't think that'd be enough time to get all of the interesting stories that Special Agent Bruce Sackman has come in contact with. Now, Mr. Sackman has written a book called Behind the Murder Curtain, and it's about medical serial killers. You've all heard of them. I think the most famous case is the Dr. Michael Swango case. And that is one that Special Agent Bruce Sackman actually worked on, knows everything about it. And Mr. Sackman, welcome, first of all, to Web Sleuths Radio. How are you? Oh, hold on. I apologize again. Blog Talk Radio caught me. Just a second. Okay, I'm sorry. It automatically mutes you when the show starts, and I keep forgetting. Mr. Sackman, welcome to Web Sleuths Radio.
And thank you very much for having me as a guest.
Are you retired now?
Well, I'm retired from the federal government, but I'm still actively employed as a private investigator here in the city of New York. I'm also the president of the Society of Professional Investigators.
Well, then you're not retired. You are working your behind off, basically. People didn't retire from retirement and come close to you yet. Career. You were eventually came to be that you were the one investigating something, a term I haven't heard before, medical serial killer. How did that come about?
Well, it came about actually as a surprise to me myself. You know, I was employed as the special agent in charge of the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, Office of Inspector General, which meant that I was in charge of all major criminal investigations for the VA hospital system from West Virginia to Maine. But my inventory, my case inventory, consisted everything except homicides. I mean, we had many frauds and bribery, and contract matters, basically a white-collar crime life. Until all of a sudden, I got a phone call that sort of changed my life. I got a call from the chief of psychiatry out at the Northport VA hospital out on Long Island and said, Bruce, you're not going to believe this, but there's a doctor working here, and there's actually been a television show about him where he's accused of killing his patients. And that's how this whole, my whole world changed, and I began the investigation and prosecution of medical serial killers.
So basically, when you started to investigate this first case, I would assume that the word got out that if there's other medical serial killers, this is the person to go to, and that launched your career into this type of investigation, right?
Well, you know what happens, Trisha, is once you're the agency person who's successful on one investigation, well, mm-hmm. then all of a sudden you become the agency expert. And that's the person that they reach out to, and that's exactly what happened to me. So the next thing I know, I find I'm doing cases in Missouri, cases in Albany, cases in Massachusetts, something I had not previously done for most of my career.
Let's talk about that first phone call. What case was that?
That was Michael Swango, you know, the famous Dr. Swango.
Right. We know him. Yes, please tell us all about him.
Well, Michael Swango was quite an interesting individual, to say the least. We could go back to the time that he was in medical school, and his fellow students used to refer to him as 00 Swango, licensed to kill.
God.
Because it seemed that every time he would visit a person, that person might die unexpectedly.
Mm-hmm.
And he was really a pretty poor student. And a number of students went to the dean of the university, of the medical school, and they said, Dean, you know, we don't think this guy should be a doctor. And the dean said, I don't care what you students say. I'm the dean. You're only the student.
Uh-huh.
I think he should be a doctor, and we're going to give him another chance. So they actually gave him another chance, and he actually became a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next thing you know, he winds up doing an internship at Ohio State University Medical Center. And the same thing happened in Ohio State University Medical Center, where patients started to die unexpectedly. One patient in particular was a young gymnast, a student. Her name was Cynthia McGee. She was 22 years old. And what happened was she had gotten into a car accident. And
mm-hmm.
she was really starting to improve until she got a visit by Dr. Michael Swango. Then all of a sudden she expired, and no one expected it ever to happen. So what happened after that was that person that hit her in the car, who was also another student, he actually got charged with vehicular homicide, but didn't kill her. It was actually Swango who killed her.
Right.
And then Swango became a paramedic, and this is the most amazing thing. He actually poisoned his coworkers, went to jail for about 5 years, came out of prison, and got his medical license again.
No,
now, you
I
might
didn't
think
hear
I'm
you.
Making that up.
I was just going to say,
I
did not hear you correctly, sir, Mr. Sackman. There's no way. You did say he got his medical license back after he was convicted and served time for poisoning his coworkers.
Yes, ma'am.
What
yes, ma'am.
Idiot.
Well,
what
I'll tell you how
idiot.
He did that. I
did
tell
this.
You how he did that. He was, you know, being a sociopath, he was a really great con artist. And this is what
mm-hmm.
he did. He convinced the medical people that he had not been in jail for poisoning, but being an ex-Marine, he got into a barroom brawl and he hurt somebody and he went to jail for that. But what happened when he came out, the governor of the state restored his civil rights and now he's a good citizen and he forged all the paperwork to make that happen. And no one went back to check and verify it. So the next thing you know, Michael Swango, after serving time in prison, becomes a medical doctor again.
We're talking with Special Agent Bruce Sackman. He wrote the book Behind the Murder Curtain. Mm-hmm. And perhaps you recognize the name, Dr. Michael Swango. And I just want to repeat this because my brain is a little soggy, and I want to make sure I'm soaking this up correctly because I'm so furious. He goes to prison for poisoning his coworkers. He gets out. He convinces the medical board or the people in charge that, no, it wasn't poisoning. It was I got into a bar brawl. And then he forges all the paperwork to show that his civil rights have been restored and so on. Now, keep in mind, though, this was way before the internet. It's really hard to get away with that nowadays, I hope. But back then, like you said, a sociopath, probably extremely charming. And who doesn't want to give a good doctor a second chance? Still, I hold the dean of that medical school responsible. First and foremost, he could have stopped it right there by investigating what the students told him and finding out, yeah, Michael Swango is a serial killer, but he didn't. And I'm assuming that he lays awake at night thinking about that. I would hope so anyway. So now we have Dr. Michael Swango, Mr. Wonderful, Mr. Love and Peace and wanting to help save the world. He's a doctor again. Then what happens?
So then he meets a young lady, a nurse, and they actually get engaged. But it doesn't work out, and they break up. And the reason why it doesn't work out and they break up, because when he's working at one hospital, someone actually found the news story about him poisoning people.
Mm-hmm.
So he had to leave that hospital, and his next stop is Stony Brook Medical Center out on Long Island. Now, Stony Brook Medical Center on Long Island is a state hospital, but it has a teaching arrangement with the VA hospital. So that's
okay.
How he came involved with the VA. Now, listen to this. He was going for a residency in guess what subject? In psychiatry. So that meant that he had to go in front of a board of trained psychiatrists to explain why he should be a resident. And that's exactly what happened. He went in front of this board of trained psychiatrists, and they said, terrific. Welcome aboard. You're on the program. We're buying all your stories. Come on over. And the next thing you know, he's at my hospital, a VA hospital out on Long Island. And patients are dying unexpectedly. And that's when I got a call. When I got the call, I said, well, I think the first thing we ought to do is go out and speak to this guy and find out his story. Let's hear exactly what he has to say. So we go to the dorm room where he is. And I'll tell you something. He was a handsome, charming ex-Marine. In fact, I said to my wife, if I didn't know better, I'd want to introduce him to my daughter.
Right.
The guy was a doctor, an ex-Marine. That sounds like the kind of guy you'd like to introduce to your daughter. And he was calm, as cool as could be, as we questioned him about his past. And we questioned him about everything. And then a day later, he leaves. He leaves. The next thing you know, we find out that eventually he's in Africa. And he's in Africa because there's a real shortage of physicians there. And in Africa, he killed women and children and pregnant women. Even attempted to kill his landlady. The question is, how are we going to get this guy back? Well, from Africa, when they started to investigate him, he wanted to go yet to another country, but he had to return to the United States first. He had to turn to the United States first to get his passport renewed. And that's when we arrested him, not for murder, but for lying on his application to the government. Because on his application to the government, which was a false statement, he actually claimed that he was a doctor, and he claimed all of those stories that we later found out were untrue. So he gets sentenced to jail, not for murder, but for false statements to the government. All right. But that gave us a window of opportunity to start our investigation. And what we did then, we had to look at every single case, every single patient that was at Northport VA Hospital at the time that Dr. Michael Swango was there. And we had to assemble a team. And this team had to take a look at all the patients and to determine if any patients seemed to die unexpectedly, not from their natural disease processes, but many patients who were actually seemed to be improving and then they unexpectedly expired. And the way we did this, because I had never did this before, remember, I was a white-collar crime investigator.
Right.
So my boss sent me to meet a man called Dr. Michael Bodden.
Dr. Bodden, we love him.
One of the world's most famous forensic medical examiners.
We adore him.
And I went to visit him, and he said, Bruce, I will help you. Bruce, I will teach you. Now, that's one hell of a teacher to have.
You got the best.
You're not kidding. And the next thing you know, we assemble the team with Dr. Bodden and other doctors, and we look at all the medical records, and the team decided that there were at least three patients that they thought might be good examples of patients who should not have expired when they did. The next thing, I find myself at a cemetery exhuming a body.
I've never
done this before. All of a sudden, a backhoe comes and it's digging up the ground. They're pulling the coffin up. And I looked at one of my agents. I said, boy, I really started something here, didn't I?
Yes, you did.
The next thing, Michael Bonin jumps into the gravesite area and starts taking soil samples. I said, what the heck is he doing? And he said, well, he's looking for arsenic, because if there's arsenic in the body, they may claim that he wasn't poisoned, but that the arsenic actually came through the soil.
Right.
Okay? So it was that arsenic in the ground, and that could have seeped into the body. Then I find myself in the morgue, and I find myself in the autopsy room. quite an experience for somebody who had never done this before.
Yeah, it was shocking, I'm sure.
It was. And we eventually, I think if memory serves me right, we exhumed 3 or 4 bodies. Now, it's very interesting because my agents, we had to go to the families. Now, imagine if this was your dad, because at that time, most of the vets were men.
Yeah.
And somebody rings your doorbell and says, you know, I'm Special Agent Bruce Ackman from the VA, and I want to talk to you about your dad's time in the hospital. And could we have permission to pull his body out of the ground and examine it? How do you think he would react to that?
Yeah, I bet people were very upset.
They were very, very, very upset. And understandably. But, you know, we were very, very compassionate to them.
Mm-hmm.
We completely understood. And all of them, you know, all of them agreed. We didn't have anyone disagree, but we had a court order anyway, even if they did disagree. But they didn't.
Well, that's good. You didn't have to use it. That's good.
No, no. And then eventually, we made the determination that at least 3 people had been poisoned.
Mm-hmm.
And they were poisoned, in our opinion, by a paralytic called succinylcholine. And that's used if they want to intubate a patient and put a tube down a patient.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how he had murdered a number of people, and he also used epinephrine, which is adrenaline.
Yes.
So now he's about to get out of jail on the white-collar crime case, you know, lying to the government on your paperwork. But we were finished just in time, because if we weren't, he would have left, and God knows he would have killed people all over the world.
He
grabbed him in
time.
And then we said to him, look, you know, if we go to trial, and even if we should lose this trial, see what we have here? We have an extradition from the government of Zimbabwe.
Mm-hmm.
So when we're finished with you, if we should lose, we're going to put you on a plane, and we're going to drop you off in Zimbabwe. Now, that might convince anybody to plead guilty.
Yes.
And that's exactly what he did.
A Zimbabwe jail, I'm sure, had a lot to do with it. What did he plead guilty to?
He pleaded guilty to murdering three of our nation's heroes at the VA cemetery in Northport, Long Island. And then it was time for sentencing. And he goes in front of Judge Mishler, and he stands at attention like a Marine, and the judge is asking him to explain in his own words what he did. And he stands, you know, I almost got like flashbacks to the Nuremberg trial. This guy stands at attention and with no remorse, not a care in the world about the victims or their families. He tells the judge how he poisoned them with a paralytic. And he goes into the details of exactly how he did it. And then the judge sentenced him to 3 consecutive life terms without the possibility of parole. And something happened that I had never heard before. Judge Mishler said that if by some reason Congress should change the law and you have a right to appeal, your appeal is denied in advance.
Good for the judge.
I had never even heard that.
Me either. That's great.
I had never even heard it. And I'll tell you something. I was there with my boss at the sentencing, who was the Inspector General of the VA. And was sitting in the courtroom, and the defense attorney, Swango's defense attorney, is putting his arm around Swango like he's a poor, innocent defendant.
Oh my God,
it was the most nauseating thing I had
I can
ever
imagine.
Seen in life. Just terrible. And then after that, of course, you know, the victims' families, they went on the news, and they said what any victim's family would say. But it was quite an experience, as you could imagine.
So is he still alive?
He's spending his time in Supermax Federal Prison in Florence, Colorado, which is the toughest, most secure prison in the United States. So he's not getting out. Oh, and by the way, remember I mentioned Cynthia McGee, that young gymnast that he killed? Well, he eventually pled guilty to that and got a life sentence for that as well. So now they're 4 life sentences.
But in reality, you know, we all know, he killed many more people than just the 4 that he admitted to, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, when you read a lot of articles about Zwango, a lot of people estimate he killed 60 people. But honestly, it may be accurate, it may not be accurate. And the reason why I say that, because medical serial killers, even when they want to cooperate, they kill so many people, they forget themselves how many people they kill. They forget themselves who their victims were, because they killed so many people.
That is not surprising in the least. So did you ever get to the bottom of what caused this man to become a sociopath and to choose the profession of a doctor and then to go and kill his patients? Something's wrong in that brain. Something happened.
Well, you're absolutely right. And it started with him as a child. And it started with him because his father, who had been special forces in Vietnam, had a scrapbook. And in this scrapbook, there were terrible things, you know, pictures of people being killed in the war. And his son, Michael, became fascinated with death, fascinated with the ability to kill people. And in my view, he's one of the few medical serial killers who actually chose the profession of medicine because it gave him the opportunity to kill. I think most medical serial killers don't really choose that profession, but things happen in their life later on. But I believe that Zwango chose that from day one because he wanted to have the power of life and death over someone. And if you think about it, you know, if you're going to choose a profession for murder, well, what profession might you choose? Well, how about one where you have the power and life or death over someone, right?
Right.
How about one where you take an oath to protect and serve and make people better? And how about a profession where the victim and the family trust you implicitly? You know, listen to that nurse, sweetheart. Listen to that doctor. They have your best interest in mind, and of course, 99.9% of the time, they do have your best interest in mind.
That's what's so
scary. How
about
working in a profession where, like, the strong and assertive become meek and mild? You know, you ever go in an emergency room and you see this tough construction worker who's terrified of this little nurse with a big needle?
Oh, yes.
They don't question. They don't ask, right?
No,
how about working
not.
In a profession where there's a shortage of skilled workers? You know, in some parts of the country, it's very hard to find nurses and doctors. Very hard. So they're willing to overlook some past indiscretions just to have somebody there. And how about working in a location where death is a common everyday occurrence? You know, if you go into a supermarket
anybody.
And pass away, oh, there's going to be a whole big investigation, maybe on television. Somebody dies in a hospital, a nursing home. Is anybody going to really care about that?
Forget about it.
You know? How about working at a place where you work alone at night? And then you draw the curtain around you and the victim. If you've ever been on a hospital ward at 3 o'clock in the morning, there's not much going on there. And if you're so intent to take somebody out, the nurse or the doctor could put that curtain around him and the patient, and no one will see what's going on. And I'll tell you something, hospitals are a place that police do not want to go into. It's
really?
An environment that the police are unfamiliar with. They're very easily challenged scientifically, administratively, and legally. Look, most cops, and I'm including myself in this, did not become cops because we were good in chemistry and biology. Okay?
Yeah, right.
And,
right.
And that's the same thing with judges and the same thing with lawyers. And, well, what about if the victim, let's say the victim cries out, you know, help, they're trying to kill me. Oh, we're not going to pay any attention to that. You know,
it's
obviously
a crazy person.
This patient is suffering from the numerous medications he issues.
Exactly.
And she has what we have a term for, you know, we call it hospital delirium. They actually become delirious, and they think somebody's trying to kill them, when in fact they're not. So now you have the perfect location, and then you have the perfect job, and then you say, so how do I kill them? Do I, like, smuggle in a knife or a gun? Well, there's no need to, because the hospital will supply all the drugs that you need to take anyone out, many of which are still untraceable with today's modern toxicology. So there you go.
And that sounds like a serial killer buffet Sunday afternoon at the most expensive restaurant. You couldn't ask for a better setup for a serial killer. Michael Swango, you said, was looking at these horrific war pictures that his father had in an album. Do you know what age he started to look at those?
You know, I'm not sure exactly, but it was pretty young. And then his parents went through a divorce. And of course, that didn't help at all.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't say exactly when, but it was pretty young, you know, according to people who knew him back then.
That would make sense. He would have to be young to develop that type of obsession. Well, okay, so Dr. Michael Swango, you caught him. He's in prison. He's not going to harm anybody else. Now you get to go back to being an FBI agent and investigating white-collar crime. Not really. Because like you said at the beginning of the show, you were the go-to guy whenever there was a question about somebody killing patients in a hospital. And I can only imagine how difficult it is to make that phone call to an FBI agent. I'm sure a lot of things have to happen before that phone call. People have to die. There has to be a lot of suspicion, right? Can you give me like an example of how it all works out?
This is what separates medical serial killers from your traditional serial killers, if that's a proper term. I don't know. Well, we'll use it, though. A traditional serial killer, the one that you read about, you know, who murders prostitutes or people jogging late at night or whatever, they usually kill, you know, let's say under 10 people and it's spread out over a long time. Medical serial killers, are you kidding me? They make the traditional serial killers seem like amateurs. The average case that I've seen is somewhere between 30 and 60, and we even have one doctor who took out close to 300 people.
Can we talk about him? That made my heart stop here. 300 people. Who is he?
Yep.
How
Dr.
did it
Harold
go down?
Shipman, S-H-I-P-M-A-N, the one and only doctor in the entire history of England to ever be successfully prosecuted for homicide. One
I've
doctor and one doctor only, going back to the beginning of time in England, was Dr. Harold Shipman. And you know how it did it? Not in the hospital. He actually made house calls.
House calls. Yes, that's right. And then they would die.
And when you walk the streets with a London detective, he will say he killed somebody in that house and somebody in this house and somebody that house down there. And, you know, mostly seniors, and no one ever suspected it until what happened, the way he got caught. He got caught because he was caught changing the will of one of his victims. He became desperate for money.
Mm-hmm.
Changed the will of one of his victims and made him the beneficiary, and that's what started the entire investigation.
Did he ever admit that he was doing this?
No. But you know why? They never admit, ever, because they don't care about the victims. It's only what it does for them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was there's a famous medical serial killer. His name is Donald Harvey. He actually worked at the VA and other hospitals before I came involved in this.
He was
and
a nurse,
a statement
right?
From Donald Harvey, and they asked him, Donald, why did you kill so many people? He says, well, after I killed the first 18, I thought I was ordained by God to do this. After all,
oh my God.
Nobody's questioning me. No, he's doubting it. Maybe I am ordained by God to do this.
Maybe I should, maybe God's telling me, keep going.
Yes.
You're doing good. Now, this was a nurse, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I remember him. And he was caught and convicted. I don't know if he's still alive or not, but
he recently passed in prison. And again, they ask him, Donald, how many people did you kill? And he scratches his head and says, well, I don't really remember. There were a lot. That's kind of the answer that you get.
You would have no idea. He could have killed hundreds as well, and nobody would have noticed. We're talking about the VA hospital. You have very sick and usually very elderly patients. So, again, not a surprise. How did they pick up on Harvey? I know that wasn't one of your cases, but do you know how they were able to finally get some suspicion going about him?
Well, if memory serves me right, Harvey, like all these other cases, start the same way, and that's with the death rate. Like every time this nurse is on duty, the death rate goes up.
Mm-hmm.
The nurse takes a vacation, the death rate goes down. And who are these people, and were they expected to die?
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't happen until after a good number of people have expired.
Sure.
And
right.
The numbers are so outrageous that somebody says, well, whoa, wait a minute, something's going on here. And that's
mm-hmm.
how just about every case that I know, that I've been aware of, comes to light. So when you open up the newspapers and you read about a recent nurse in Japan that killed 30-plus people, a nurse
mm-hmm.
in Germany that killed over 100 people, a couple of nurses in Italy that killed 30, 40, 50 people, you say, these numbers are incredible. But they're incredible because nobody picks up on it until the death rate really kind of jumps off the charts. Pretty scary.
And that is scary. And the fact of the matter is, like you said, it has to really show up before people have any suspicion. Somebody could kill 18 people, and then maybe they might be suspicious of why when this nurse, this doctor, whatever, comes on duty, all of a sudden the death rate skyrockets. But it does have to come to a point, and there are victims that are murdered, and they go unnoticed. I'm sure that happens. You're the You caught Michael Swango. You got him in prison. You did the great job that you did. Now you are the medical serial killer hunter. So what happens next? Tell us about phone call number two.
Well, the next thing I know, as if Swango wasn't enough, I hear about this. I get a phone call about a nurse in Massachusetts. Her name was Kristen Gilbert.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Kristen Gilbert was alleged to have killed a number of patients in the intensive care unit, in the ICU. But how did this all come about? Well, it came about through a couple of nurses that were questioning the death rate and questioning her. But it's
mm-hmm.
not that easy, because you have to remember, it takes a lot of courage. A lot of courage to be a whistleblower, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And there are huge obstacles for whistleblowers. In fact, there's a famous case that everyone should actually read. It was in the New York Times a number of years ago called Nurses Fired for Alleging Misconduct Settled Their Suit. Well, they weren't actually fired. They were actually criminally prosecuted. And I
mm-hmm.
can tell you that story in a bit, but let's get back to Kristen Gilbert. So Kristen Gilbert, now my vision of a serial killer has always been like a Charles Manson type, you know, with a swastika on his head.
Mm-hmm.
Really
oh, sure.
Guy.
Absolutely.
Here
Ted
you
Bundy.
Have
just
a typical soccer
that.
Mom. You know, if you went to a game and she's out there with her kids, there's the typical soccer mom who's a nurse at the VA hospital. Who
mm-hmm.
would ever suspect anything like that? All right. But what happened is every time Nurse Gilbert was on duty, and we've heard this story, the death rate went up. She'd take a vacation. The death rate went down. And people started to suspect, say, what's going on with her? Well, meanwhile, there were a lot of things going on in her life as well. She was going through a divorce, and her boyfriend was actually a VA police officer who used to respond every time there was a code. Now, let's talk a little bit about codes, okay?
Okay.
If someone goes into cardiac arrest, and we've all probably seen this in the hospital, the nurses and the doctors come running in with a crash cart, and it's very exciting. Now, we have discovered throughout the world that there are some nurses, and we refer to them as code junkies. They
mm-hmm.
love the excitement of the code, all right?
And it
nurse
is, you're, like you said, it's
certainly
life,
one of them.
Life and death.
Right?
Life and death, and it's like nothing you've ever experienced before. I was an EKG tech, and I know exactly what you mean. It is an incredible experience.
Oh, it is? And
mm-hmm, absolutely.
There is a psychological condition known as Munchausen syndrome by proxy.
Oh,
and
yes.
And a number of nurses, we believe, actually have this condition. And this is the way
mm-hmm.
it works. Munchausen syndrome comes about from the term Munchausen, which was a character that made bold stories about his exploits throughout the world. Munchausen syndrome is a patient that will go and actually harm himself because he wants to get cared. He wants to be cared for.
Mm-hmm.
Munchausen syndrome by proxy, and we see this sometimes with a mother that will intentionally harm her child and bring her child to the emergency room to show the staff what a caring, loving mother she is. This is
mm-hmm.
Munchausen syndrome by proxy, and this is exactly what some nurses do. They will intentionally cause a code because they enjoy the excitement of the code and because they want to show the staff what a great leader they are. When
mm-hmm.
you looked in the evaluation of Kristen Gilbert as a regular nurse, average. But when it came to codes, outstanding. And even the doctors would say, you know, if I ever coded, I would want Nurse Gilbert to come in.
She charged,
you know, she barks orders, even to all the young interns who are scared out of their mind, who have never done
mm-hmm.
anything like this. She's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what she loved. She craved that excitement of a code. Now, if you
right.
cause the code, well, that's not a good thing.
No, it's not at
exactly
all.
And that's exactly what she did. And sometimes people would die, and sometimes they wouldn't. But not only was it a Munchausen syndrome by proxy for her, but in her case, there was actually a sexual experience to it, and I'll explain it to you.
Mm-hmm.
Her boyfriend, who was a VA police officer, completely innocent of any wrongdoing, by the way, under the VA rules, every time there was a code, a VA police officer would have to show at the code as well. So
mm-hmm.
while she's there working on the patient, people testify that the two of them would be like grabbing each other. And one time, she straddled the patient to show her garter belt, and he was there. And it actually became like a sexual experience for the both of them as well. While the poor patient is there dying.
Dear Lord.
Incredible, isn't it?
That is
really,
incredible.
Really, really incredible. But, you know, Kristen Gilbert had a lot of other problems. And one of the problems she had when she became under investigation, this whole thing got really too big for her, she phoned in a bomb threat. And were able to show that she was the one that phoned in the bomb threat. So once again, we were able to put a medical serial killer in jail for a while, not for killing patients, but for another crime, which gave us an opportunity to do the investigation.
Mm-hmm.
And then we did the investigation with pretty much the same team. And we were able to show that a number of patients were killed with epinephrine, which is adrenaline, which sped
mm-hmm.
up their heart and caused their death unnecessarily. And we were able to show that all the deaths were consistent with epinephrine poisoning. She also got, I think it was 3 counts of first-degree murder without the possibility of parole, and she's
mm-hmm.
in Texas now. You know something interesting about her?
What's that?
In my office one day, and somebody brings in a newspaper article, and they say, Bruce, look at this. And it's Kristen Gilbert engaged in caged heat affair. What the heck is that?
What?
Right? Apparently, she was having a lesbian relationship with Squeaky Fromm. Remember the one who tried to kill President Ford?
Yes.
And she
who
was
could
doing
forget
that
her?
Just because she wanted to get in the newspapers again. She wanted that publicity again. Even in prison, it was incredible. You know, during the trial, and we went to trial on this, the trial
mm-hmm.
lasted 6 months long, okay?
Six months?
Every day. She couldn't wait to get the day's newspaper because in this small town of Massachusetts, this was the biggest story ever.
Mm-hmm.
So she couldn't wait to get the newspaper. She couldn't wait to read about herself every day. And when she was in prison, and I'm not kidding you, she actually started writing a book about a nurse who murders their patients.
I don't even know what to say. That just leaves me speechless. Did she think people would actually buy it? I mean, it sounds like she would just write out a confessional and say, this is not real, like O.J. did. If I did it, here's how I would do it. So, first
yes,
of all,
that's
two
right.
questions.
Oh, you're absolutely right.
two questions.
Sure.
Was there a medical test, a chemical test, for the adrenaline drug, or did it dissipate immediately? I seem to remember something about that.
Oh, that's a great question. That's a great question. So what happened was we needed to find that answer out.
Mm-hmm.
Can you find traces of epinephrine or norepinephrine in embalmed tissue? So we went to the number one private forensic lab in the world, and it's called the Reader's Lab, and they're in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, Bruce, I'll never forget this, they said, Bruce, we have this brand new machine. It's called the High Pressure Liquid Chromatography Tandem Mass Spectrometer. Holy cow, what the hell is that?
How did you pronounce that?
Bruce?
You need an award just for pronouncing that without stumbling over it. Wow.
They said, don't worry, we'll get a sample and we'll put it through the machine and it'll come out and it says epinephrine.
Mm-hmm.
Great, it came out and said epinephrine. Then we're about to go to trial. And the lab calls up and they say, hey, you know, Bruce, I'm sorry, we made a mistake.
Oh,
we really
no.
can't say as an absolute fact that it's epinephrine, but have a nice trial.
No.
So then we
oh,
had to
my.
Go to the defense and tell the defense, you know, what happened.
But
right. we were able to show to our medical experts that the deaths were consistent with epinephrine poisoning, even though we didn't have the toxicology. And I must say, I gave the prosecutor, you know, not every prosecutor would have went forward with that.
A lot of
but
them
the prosecutor went forward with that because he was convinced that science was still on our side, even though we didn't have the toxicology. And you know something interesting now? This case in Massachusetts was actually a death penalty case. And the reason
mm-hmm.
why it was a death penalty case was because the murder occurred on the exclusive territory of the United States, being a VA hospital. You see,
mm-hmm.
not every VA hospital is exclusive territory, and this is the way it works. VA hospitals sort of come in three different flavors, you might say. There's exclusive territory in the United States, which is like a military base.
Right.
If somebody kills somebody on a military base, it's not a local crime, it's a federal crime because it's
federal crime,
on
sure.
the territory of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way it was out in Northport. Now, out in Massachusetts, it was actually something called concurrent jurisdiction, which means
mm-hmm.
that both the state and the federal have jurisdiction. So because we tried her in federal court, this was actually a death penalty case in a case in a state that does not have the death penalty.
Because it was a federal case.
Penalty.
Yep. Did she get death?
And
did
the
she
jury
get
came back, and of course they said she's guilty, but they did not want to give the death penalty. And I can tell you this, in spite of what it said in the press, the prosecution team was actually kind of happy about that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she had two small children, and we really didn't want to see her executed. But we had to make the case because that was our job.
Exactly.
We had to make the case.
You had more compassion, obviously, than that nurse ever had in her life. Second question, when did people start suspecting Nurse Gilbert? How many people had to die before the alarm was raised? Do you know?
There were a lot. I mean, I'm trying to think back now because now this is what happened. And, you know, we're talking about whistleblowers. So the nurses went to the management. Now, imagine if you're a management in the hospital and you're very, very concerned about the reputation of the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
Next thing you know, two nurses come up and say, I think we have a serial killer here. Oh, that's going to go over real big. Real
right.
big, man.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So this is the answer that I all heard in almost every case. They say, yeah, okay, nurse, let me ask you this. Did you actually see this nurse or doctor kill anybody? Well, no, I didn't see him, but you see, every time she's on duty, the death rate goes up, and that whole argument. Well, that doesn't mean she murdered them. I mean, there could be a lot
mm-hmm.
of factors, a lot of medical
sure.
factors, scientific factors. That doesn't mean she murdered anybody.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and are you prepared to testify, nurse whistleblower? I mean, is your background so perfect? You ever use any drugs? I'm just asking because, you know, if you go to trial, you're going to have to go on the stand. I mean, is your license up to snuff?
Mm-hmm.
But in spite of that, a number of nurses in Massachusetts, they went to management, and after management, did their own inquiry. They came back and said, we believe all these patients died from their natural disease processes.
Oh, no. Nurse Gilbert.
Oh, no, was right.
Got
now,
away
let me tell
with
you, I've seen this many times. Many times, because the thing is, who's doing this review? Are these forensic people? Are these forensic toxicologists? Are these professional investigators? Or is this the medical staff who's not really sure what to look for? I mean, if you run a standard tox screen and you don't have any particular drugs that you're looking for, you're not going to find this stuff. And I'll tell you something else. You know, when I first got involved with this case, because it was in the VA hospitals and because many of the vets were old and long-term patients, and I would look in their medical files as a layperson, I didn't know you could be alive and have this much wrong with you. And then I have to prove murder?
Yeah, right.
That's going to be a challenge, right?
Yeah, big time challenge.
We were able to do it. But it, Swango case, by the way, from beginning to end, because remember there was a time it was in Africa, was 7 years long.
Seven years long. Wow.
From
boy, you don't give up,
and
that's
the call
great.
To the time he was actually convicted and sentenced to prison was 7 years. The average one of these cases take many, many years. They are very intense. And let me say, no one investigator could do this case. I don't care if you're the world's greatest investigator, the reincarnation of Sherlock Holmes, you can't do this by yourself. It takes a team. It takes a village. You have to have investigators and toxicologists. And you know what? You have to have a lot of money. And what small police department, if they get called to the local hospital where they know everybody anyway, is going to have the kind of expertise and resources to conduct an investigation like this? Not
it's
many.
Very rare, very difficult.
Very
let's, a couple of questions to go back to Nurse Gilbert really quickly, if I may. Has there been a test developed now that can show adrenaline in tissue that has been embalmed? Has that been fixed?
Not to my knowledge.
Okay.
Not to my knowledge. I know they've been working on it ever since Gilbert. They've been working on it. And, you know, the same thing, by the way, the same thing with succinylcholine. Because Swango pled guilty. We didn't have to prove that he used succinylcholine. He said he used succinylcholine. Now, let me tell you about Nurse Williams. And inside the book, this is the one case that got away. You know, they haven't been successful. There was a Nurse Williams who allegedly killed 60 of our nation's heroes in Missouri, in the Harry S. Truman Medical Center in Missouri. And the case had been around for a long time. The FBI had tried. The VAOIG had tried. They could not determine the cause of death in these patients. It was very, very hard. One of the patient's family sued and won. They won claiming that this Richard Williams had actually murdered the people. But remember, the level of proof on a civil case is much different than the level of proof on a criminal case. So
much
a level
easier.
Of proof is, you know, a preponderance of evidence. That's not the same as beyond a reasonable doubt.
Correct.
And in fact, the government scientists, and Dr. Michael Bonham was one of them, said he couldn't determine at that time what the cause of death was. So we went back to the Reader's Lab. The Reader's Lab said, Bruce, I have this machine. You remember that story, right?
Oh, yeah.
And we'll, and we'll put some sample in our machine. It'll come out, and boom. It comes out succinylcholine. So Williams gets indicted on 13 counts of killing our nation's heroes at the Harry S. Truman Medical Center. Next thing you know, the FBI lab tries to do the same test that the Reader's Lab did. They couldn't show succinylcholine. So what happened was the indictment had to be dismissed. Because prosecutor at that time, unlike the prosecutor in Gilbert, felt that without the science, he cannot go forward. So Richard Williams leaves the VA and he goes to a private nursing home. You want to guess what happened at the nursing home?
I would.
The death
think
rate goes up.
The death rate probably went sky high, and who even noticed?
Absolutely. Absolutely went up. Now he's not in the medical world anymore. He's somewhere in Missouri, but he got away with it. I'm telling you, he did it. I have no doubts about it. I'll give you an example. One of his patients, you know what happens in a hospital is that the patients hear the nurses talking. And the nurses say, oh, there goes Richard Williams. You know, he's the angel of death.
Right.
So the patient says, angel of death, that's my nurse. I'm getting the hell out of here.
I'm getting, exactly.
So he runs out of the hospital, physically runs out of the hospital. The VA police, they do their job. They run after him. They bring him back. That night he died unexpectedly.
Oh, dear God.
The management of the hospital says, okay, I tell you what we're going to do. We're going to assign another nurse to work with Richard Williams. And when the other nurse was assigned to Richard Williams, the death rate never went off.
Mm-hmm.
But when that second nurse had to take a day off, needed a vacation or whatever, guess what happened to the death rate?
Oh,
boom.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, why can't they see that? I mean, it's so obvious. Are they,
because
I guess
that
they're
alone,
so terrified for their jobs.
You know, will not get a prosecutor. Will not, at least that prosecutor, and I'm not knocking him, because when we had the meeting and I was practically begging him to go forth with the trial, he would say, well, then you go ahead and prosecute him, Bruce. And he knows that, again, I'm not a prosecutor.
Right.
So, you know, and I'm not faulting him because, you know, he looks at it the way a different way than I do. But that was my one of my big disappointments in life. We had spent a lot of time, a lot of money. We tried our best, but that's the one that got away. And it's in the book. He got away.
And the book is called Behind the Murder Curtain. Let me remind everybody, we're talking with former FBI agent Bruce Sackman, who was basically...
Well, not FBI, not FBI.
What did I
say?
V-A-O-I-G. Special agent. Sorry.
I know it's a lot of letters.
special agent
letters,
Bruce Sackman.
Yes.
Well, I'll give you all kinds of titles during this interview, okay? And then you can just add them on. I apologize.
Okay.
But
no,
anyway, the book is fantastic. And Mr. Sackman, could you stay a little longer? I know I told your people that it would be about an hour, but I just have so many more questions.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay, great.
You know, I could talk about this all day.
Well, hey, I could listen all day, and so could the listeners as well. The book is called Behind the Murder Curtain. It is available at Amazon. Now, did they ever find out? Two questions. Actually, three here. Two for Richard Williams. Does he still have his medical or his nurse's license? And
no.
Again,
he's not in the medical field in any way, shape, or form anymore. Thank God. Thank God.
Thank God. Did you look into his background? Did you find out what happened to him?
Well, you know what? Yeah. He had many, many personal and domestic problems. He actually had an order of protection against his wife for a while. I mean, they went through a divorce, and the wife later alleged that she thought Richard had actually murdered her own parents, but I don't think anything ever came of that with the local police.
Mm-hmm.
A whole long history of private personal problems outside of being a nurse, which is not uncommon, just like Gilbert and Swango. Oh, and by the way, you know, I forgot to tell you something about Swango. Can I throw it in? It's very interesting.
Please, yes,
remember
go
I
ahead.
I told you Swango had a fiance and then they separated?
Yes.
Well, one day the fiance, and she had been a VA nurse, and then she goes home to Virginia and she visits mom and she's very sad. So she goes to a local park, takes out a gun, and blows her brains out right in the park. Now, look,
oh,
you can't blame Swango for that, can you? Yes, you can, because
absolutely.
Even though the body was cremated, mom saved a lock of the hair, and we had it analyzed, and it was loaded with arsenic, with arsenic. Swango
not a
was
surprise.
Actually poisoning his own fiancée.
He was poisoning anybody that he could get away with it, especially those close to him.
Poison his landladies. Everybody was a target of opportunity. You didn't have to be in the hospital. You could be anywhere.
Oh, God, that whole thing about playing God and the power of it all, and then him seeing those pictures at such a young age, it just all kind of the perfect recipe for a psychopathic serial killer. Now, a little bit ago, you mentioned about these nurses that were or were not prosecuted. There was a couple of them, you said. Does that sound familiar, or am I just making
this
up?
Yes, I know about.
Okay.
You know, every couple of months, you'll open up the newspaper, and you'll read about one of these nurses somewhere in the world. The most recent one was in Japan,
mm-hmm.
where she murdered about 30 of her patients, and she timed it in such a way. She this is her own statement. I've never heard this before. She said she timed it in such a way that the patient would die on another nurse's watch, not hers, because she claims she didn't like to call the family and give the family the bad news. So she made sure that the patient died on another nurse's watch.
Oh, well, how kind of her
before.
When she's murdering her loved
one,
she doesn't like to do the call. Boy, what a nice sweetheart. She was captured, and I'm assuming she was prosecuted, right? And
yes.
Successfully.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Good.
There's a nurse in Canada recently.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing, you know, with the codes. Killed 40, 50 people. That was recently in the news. There's a big one in Germany that originally was prosecuted for a handful of murders, and
mm-hmm.
they went back and they did their homework, and they're up to 97 murders now.
Oh, my gosh.
All these stories are on the internet. And in Italy, for some reason, I don't know what's going on in Italy, there are about 3 new medical serial killer cases, and one of them, very interesting. This woman,
mm-hmm.
her first name is Gabrielle. Gabrielle
mm-hmm.
Used to like to take a selfie of herself and the victim after she killed the victim. And she had a collection of these selfies. Same thing happened. People said, why is the death rate going up? Same type of investigation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because she's living with her boyfriend, and the police come to the door one day, and they say, Gabrielle, you're under arrest for 30 murders. She goes, okay.
Mm-hmm.
And the boyfriend goes, okay.
Okay.
Okay. What do you mean, okay? She's all set up, Giuseppe. You know, I'll handle this. And she just goes out and, you know, cares nothing at all about the victims. It's all what the incident did for her. Now, Swango, interestingly enough, used to love to call up the families after he killed the patient
mm-hmm.
and in great detail go through how the patient expired. Because when he did that, he was reliving the experience, reliving the excitement that he had from killing patients. So could you imagine the doctor calls up, and you think your dad is actually improving and says, you know, this is Dr. Swango. You know, I'm very sorry to say that your father passed, and this is what happened. You know, he was suffering, he was coughing, he was choking, he was this, he was that. And could you imagine this? Imagine these poor families. Incredible.
And he sounds, he's probably animated while he's telling them this. I'm sure it's very shocking.
He's enjoying every minute of it.
Right.
Every minute of that conversation gave him an opportunity to relive the excitement of actually
mm-hmm.
killing somebody.
You know, I think we talked about a little bit about this before the show, that there are these medical serial killers everywhere. And that's why it's very important if you have a loved one in the hospital or you're in the hospital that you're diligent about your care because you never know, right? I mean, this could
be absolutely.
You have no idea how
absolutely.
Many people are going through this right now. Let's say, Mr. Sackman, that somebody has a relative in a nursing home and they are suspicious that even though it just looked like a normal heart attack, they're suspicious that something else happened. They have any guess they just go to the bath.
You know, it's very, very tough, and I get a lot of these calls. It's very, very tough, particularly, you know, in a nursing home, particularly if it's a hospice situation. You know, people are in hospice. And
mm-hmm.
there was a famous case, by the way, out in Texas, where according to the Medicare and Medicaid reimbursement, if a patient is in hospice too long, there won't be any more reimbursement because the government says, you aren't supposed to keep a patient in hospice that long. We're only paying you for X amount of time, let's say 30 days or 15 days.
Uh-huh.
I don't remember what it was. So the manager told the staff, hey, look, we can't have any patients living here more than the Medicaid or Medicare rules because we're going to lose money. And he ordered them to murder the patients. You can read all about this on the web. It's a famous hospice case in Texas.
That is, that's just shocking. You know, I had a personal experience, and I'm going to relay it to you and just ask you what you think, okay? My father was in a home, very active guy, had the great health other than he was 84 years old. And one day I got a call, and it was his nurse. They had a nurse there. And he made me guess what happened. He didn't call up and say, it looks like your father is having a heart attack. You do have a do not resuscitate, but I'm just checking to see if that's what you really want to do. He didn't say that. He called me up, and I'm just, to the best of my memory, this may not be exact, but he said, I think you should come see your father. I said, excuse me? And he goes, it's time you should see your father. And I said, well, why? Well, he said he didn't want to go to the hospital. Anyway, it went on like that. And it felt like it took forever for him to say, do you want us to hold to the order of do not resuscitate? I couldn't say yes to that. Even though I believed it, my father would have been so angry if he knew that I said, no, call an ambulance, because I was so shocked. And, of course, the ambulance got there, and it was way too late. And I don't know why he did that. My father was still alive when he called. I live 45 minutes away. I wasn't going to get there in time to hold his hand and be with him when he died. But I don't understand why he did that. It was the weirdest thing. It has bothered me, and I think about it every day. And
I'm
just
sure
assumed that he was a very awkward nurse. My father loved him. Had no problem with him. I thought he was great too, but I don't know. I'm not saying he's a killer, not at all. But don't you think that's odd?
You know,
I'm sorry.
It's interesting you mentioned, and I should have mentioned this before, the DNR, do not resuscitate, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Swango used to insert DNR unbeknownst to the family. Because if a patient
really?
Has DNR, yeah, well, look, if there's a patient DNR, it's not going to be a big investigation. There's not going to be an autopsy. There's not going to be anything.
Mm-hmm.
The patient is do not resuscitate. So, you know, the family and the patient, they actually, you know, want the patient to pass peacefully, you know, without all those extra life-saving methods,
mm-hmm.
you know, all those like life-saving techniques. So Swango used to go in and actually – in the medical records, and this is before electronic medical records, but he used to just write in DNR as for family, and it wasn't true. The family
wow.
said, what are you talking about? We never made, you know, dad DNR. What are you
mm-hmm.
talking about? One of
oh,
the
boy,
many,
he was
many
slick.
Techniques. Oh, yeah, another thing that we saw, particularly with Kristen Gilbert, that when we went through the medical files, and those suspicious deaths, very interestingly, EKG records were missing. Why
mm-hmm.
were they missing? Okay, again, this is before electronic medical records. Well, that's because the EKG is actually sort of a roadmap as to what happened. So
right,
you can
see
exactly, you know, the patient's
everything.
Doing fine, the patient's doing fine, and boom. And that could pretty much pinpoint to you something that happened at what particular time. But for some reason, in Kristen Gilbert's cases, we couldn't find the EKGs anywhere. That was a red flag.
Oh, big time red flag. Because you'd be able to see the heart was just fine, and then boom. And something like adrenaline would cause it to, would cause the heart to go into cardiac arrest. Well, I wonder, Mr. Sackman, I wonder what we can do. Like I said earlier, you have to be diligent. But do you have, like, maybe even a checklist that we could perhaps put in our mind so next time we're with somebody or perhaps we're in the hospital ourselves, we can mentally check this off and make sure that they are getting proper care and are not being treated by a serial killer?
Well, in the book, we have 26 red flags, but this is for nurses and doctors who suspect something. And we go through the 26 rules of evidence, you might say, that we were able to uncover that was very common among medical serial killers. But for families, the best thing is, you know, you have to question. You have to be polite, but you have to be aggressive. And the nursing staff has to know that there's a patient representative with that patient all the time. Because if the patient is by him or herself and the family very rarely comes, there's chances are, there's a high probability that something is, may happen to expedite the death of that patient. Okay? Now, we could debate, you know, forever patients that are seriously ill and a lot of pain and the family wants to help them and all. That's not what I'm talking about here.
Exactly.
Now, right, there's inside the book, inside Behind the Murder Curtain, there's a very interesting story about a doctor in Connecticut. The doctor in Connecticut, this patient was on a morphine drip. The doctor took it upon himself, you know, I think this patient has suffered enough. And he just turned the valve and all the morphine came in and he killed the patient and he admitted to it. Well, the nurse that was there said, "Doc, what the hell are you doing? You can't do that." He said, "Yes, I can." Wow. So we did an investigation. And we were able to find out exactly what happened because we took the pump, we sent the morphine pump to the manufacturer. They were able to give us the date and time, exactly what happened. And even the doctor admitted it. So I brought the case to the U.S. attorney in Connecticut. She declined the case.
Really?
Declined the case. Boy, was I pissed.
I don't blame you.
And I did something I had never done in my entire career.
What was that?
And, you know, I used to teach a course how to present cases for prosecution to the U.S. attorney's office. And one thing I used to say in my courses, I used to say, don't ever appeal, don't ever challenge the decision of the U.S. attorney not to prosecute, because it's only going to be bad for you. And I went against my own teaching, and I actually went to the Department of Justice in Washington, D.C. And I had Michael Bodden behind me, and I had a medical ethicist from Harvard behind me, and we all said this doctor had no right to play God. He had no right to do this. And they said, "Bruce, you're right, but we're not going to prosecute." And the whole
appeal
and everything was just a waste of time. They felt that they couldn't get a criminal prosecution out of this, that the jury would be too understanding for what the doctor did. And I was, look, not every case is successful. And boy, was I pissed. And it stuck in my craw for a long time. So meanwhile, you know, it's interesting. The doctor said, "Oh, I know this is something the family would want. The family would have wanted me to end dad suffering." Well, the family had a very strange way of showing that because they sued the doctor.
I bet they won.
"Doctor, we never told you to do this. What the hell are you doing?" They sued the doctor and they sued the VA. And they got a, settlement out of it.
I bet they did.
Yeah.
They should have. And the problem is, I know there are people out there now thinking, well, you know, that doctor had compassion. Maybe he did do the right thing. And I can understand a prosecutor thinking that the jury, they would be thinking that as well. But you never know what he's going to do the next time. Maybe the next time it's not somebody quite as ill as dad was in this case, as the father was.
You know, if the doctor had conversations with the family, if the doctor had conversations with the patient, if it was a clear understanding they wanted dad's, you know, life to end and not go through any suffering, I would understand that. But here you have the family saying, "What the hell are you doing? We never
told you to do that.
We never authorized you to do that. The patient never had a discussion with you saying, okay, doc, whenever you think it's ready, take me out." This guy was playing God.
Right.
And, you know, but we couldn't get it prosecuted.
Boy, I bet that was frustrating. Very frustrating.
Yeah.
Now, when did you you said you retired from being a special agent, but you did not retire, as we found out first in the beginning of the episode. You work like three big jobs all the time. You're a private investigator, and you do several other things. So when you retired, you decided to write this book. What happened? Did you just say, God, I got so many stories, and they'd make a great book, and boom, you went with it? I mean,
no,
it's great.
This is what happened. You know, I retired in 2005. So it's been, 13 years since I've retired. And what happens is I go around the country, speak about suspicious deaths in medical centers. Mm-hmm. I make presentations actually all over the world. I did one in Dubai a couple of months ago. I have one coming up in Wales next year. So I go around the world and I'm teaching this, and people always say, Bruce, why don't you write a book? Why don't you write a book? Oh, I'm not really an author. And then at one meeting of the Society of Professional Investigators, our annual dinner, someone got up and they introduced me as an expert on medical serial killers. And these two authors were sitting in the audience, Michael Vecchione and Jerry Schmetterer, and they said, medical serial killers? This sounds like our next book.
It is. That's a great title.
They approached me, and the rest is history.
How long ago was that? Was it just a couple of years ago, or was it recently?
About a year ago, yeah.
So how's the book doing, and how are things going with you since the book is released?
Well, the book just came out last Wednesday.
So
I don't even know, you know, how well it's doing. The New York Post had a large two-page story on it, and the Federal Law Enforcement Officers Association had a large one-page offer on it. But I haven't seen any figures yet, so I don't know what's going on. But to me, you know, I didn't write this book as, you know, as something that I was looking for great financial success. That had nothing to do with it at all. I thought it was very important for people all over the world, because I see this when I teach, to understand what happened and the importance of making sure that you question politely, but you question all the treatment that your loved one is getting. And look, the overwhelming majority of healthcare providers are honest, hardworking, dedicated people who actually perform miracles. I mean, I've seen miracles performed in hospitals by medical staff. So I don't want to leave any listener with the impression that I don't have a world of respect for doctors and nurses. In fact, part of our team that investigates these cases is a fairly new discipline called forensic nursing. And what forensic nursing is, it's men and women who have been trained as nurses and also trained in forensic science. And they could bridge the gap between what the doctors are saying that I may not really understand and the lay people. And plus they understand the politics of the hospital. They understand the rules and regulations. They are phenomenal. No one has more respect than I do for nurses and medical professionals. And because they're such a respected group, that's why these outliers are able to exist and kill so many people until they actually get caught.
I would think the American Medical Association or somebody would come up with some guidelines, with some things to look out for, and one of them would be, does the person is on duty? To me, that's an easy call to make. And if the death rate, I don't know what it would be, goes up, you know, 20% for 4 months in a row every time this person works, that's a pretty good indicator. I would think they could self-police a little bit more, but maybe not. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, you know, the question is how many hospitals are actually tracking that? You know, how many hospitals are tracking the death rate per ward and per employee? I don't think too many, to tell you the truth.
Probably not.
I don't really think too many.
Well, I wish
because
they would.
This
I think
normally happens when someone notices something, and then they get someone to do the tracking. And then they do the tracking and the watching. And by then, you have, unfortunately, a number of victims, and you hope and pray it's not someone in your family.
Boy, there you go. That is the truth. So what is up next for you? You're going to Wales, you say, and who are you presenting your speech to? Is it law enforcement in Wales?
I'm presenting it to the Association of British Investigators. in Wales next year. And but I always get called, and I'm always eager to go anywhere. I mean, I am going up next week to the state police. New York State Police have a homicide seminar. I teach there every year. There are homicide investigators from all over the world, and they have great homicide experience. It's very rare to find someone who actually investigated a medical serial killer. So they're all very fascinated with this. And
of course,
me leave you with one thought, because I think the future of MSKs is a little bit different. Because now we have all these medical devices that are hooked up to the internet. Right?
Yes.
Many of them that are inserted in patients can actually be monitored and sometimes adjusted by the internet. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Many of the devices in the hospitals, like infusion pumps and many other devices, are also electronically hooked up to the internet.
Mm-hmm.
If you wanted to kill somebody, if you wanted to blackmail a hospital, if you wanted to call all this kind of chaos, and we read in the paper all the time about hospital medical records, right, that are compromised.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And the bad guys want ransomware. They want money for this. But there's nothing, very little to stop them from getting in the system and all of a sudden taking out patients in a ward where all the machines are hooked to the internet. There's a lot of concern about this. Has it happened? I don't know, because no hospital is going to admit to it. Anecdotally, I've heard some stories, but I can't say for an absolute fact that it has been. But the government is very concerned about this. But I don't believe that all the safeguards that are in place. Now, Dick Cheney had a pacemaker. If you recall, this was in the newspaper, a pacemaker that was hooked up to the internet. It could be monitored and adjusted by his physicians. They had to remove that internet portion from his pacemaker because they feared that it could be hacked, change the setting, and kill him. This,
oh my
to me,
God! That's
the future of medical serial killers.
Science fiction is what that is, but it's coming true.
Yes.
That is fascinating, and I would hope that the medical community and the government oversight would at least be a couple of steps ahead of a hacker being able to do that. I mean, think about it. It could be a terrorist attack.
Oh, I know it could happen because there's something called the Black Hat Conference. The Black Hat Conference are hackers. Most of them are ethical hackers, meaning that they hack to try to find problems in the system and fix them. And at the last Black Hat Conference, I was told, there was actually a demonstration where they hacked into a medical device in a hospital that could have been that but wasn't hooked up to a patient. Now, that's scary, where you could be an MSK and not even leave your bedroom.
That is frightening. You know what else this could be, if I may make a suggestion, although I know you didn't do this for money? I swear, this could be a great TV show. Medical serial killer hunter. Really. And every week they have a new case, and it's based on you. So, you know, look that up in Hollywood. Maybe you'll be on maybe your life story will be told very soon in a certain type of TV show. I think that would be wonderful. Have you been approached about a TV show or movie?
Well, I know my co-authors have been. I sort of let them handle that because, you know, I'm like a man on a mission. You know, I'm more on the mission, and they handle, you know, the business end of it. But yeah, it could certainly happen. You know,
I think that would be fantastic. Okay, everybody, listen. This is Big Mama, Tricia, telling you need to go and buy this incredible book. It's by Bruce Sackman, and it's called Behind the Medical Curtain, and it's all about his life. Murder Curtain. Behind the Murder Curtain. It's all about his life chasing medical serial killers. They're out there still. We need to be vigilant, especially in the hospitals today. So get this book. You'll be scared to death for the rest of your life about the medical physician, but trust me, like you said, Mr. excuse me, I'm choking to death here. Mr. Sackman, like you said, the 99.9999% of the doctors and nurses are fabulous, wonderful people, and they're not serial killers. But it's
absolutely
a fascinating book. I'm going to have a quiz on it later, so you better read it, people. I'm telling you. Behind the Murder Curtain, about medical serial killers, by Special Agent Bruce Sackman. And, Mr. Sackman, do you have a website, or does your book have a website by
chance?
Yes,
yes. It's BehindTheMurderCurtain.com.
There you go.
The book, BehindTheMurderCurtain.com, and it lists all the speaking engagements that I have coming up, and it talks, it has all the latest medical serial killer stories from all around the world. Pretty fascinating site.
Okay, that's easy to remember, BehindTheMurderCurtain.com. Bruce Sackman, thank you so much for being on Web Sleuth Radio. I really appreciate it. I know this show is going to get a zillion downloads, so we'll have you on again soon, okay?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Take care now. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Wow, that was fascinating, wasn't it? Dang. Medical serial killer. You just got to wonder how many are out there. Is somebody a serial killer? If they do maybe adjust the morphine just a little bit more so the person that is dying a horrible death dies, are they a serial killer if they do that 5 or 6 times in their career? I don't know. Technically, yes. You don't want anybody doing something like that, just making up their own mind that that person has to die right now. Not good. But think about the Michael Swangos out of the world out there who get a thrill out of this. Nurse Gilbert, who got a sexual thrill because her boyfriend was in security and he'd rush up whenever there was a code blue. Boy, you got to wonder. Like I said earlier, a good hospital with a great staff is like a fabulous buffet to a medical serial killer. They're not going to want to admit that there's something wrong with the people in their positions. So it'll seem really hard to prove. But I do think, if I may get on my soapbox here, and I'll get off it shortly, I do think there has got to be a way to monitor the death rate when a professional is on duty. The nurse, the doctor, the physician's assistant, whoever has access to the medicine and to the room and the patient, I think that should be, in this day and age with computers, that should be easy to keep track of. And then if there is a really big high jump and there's no other explanation, then you have to look into it. And I don't know. That's just me. You might have a different opinion. If you do, you can keep it to yourself. That's my show. Kidding. We'll be back again soon. Levi Page was supposed to join us, but as usual, the men of my life let me down and he stood me up. No, he had to go to the dentist. He really did. So we'll have Levi on again real soon. Hey, everybody, get to websleuth.com. We have the new software. We just hope you come back again soon, okay? Websleuth.com, Web Sleuth Radio, Tricia Griffith saying so long. Have a great day. Take care now. Bye-bye.